It's another installment of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Back from black to white.
Hi everyone, I'm David Grealish and I'm hosting show 24 of the RCR today, Sunday, March 11th.
Will I ever find my way back to Oz?
I'm joined here by my buds, Carrington Banson and Earl Evans. How you guys?
Chatter.
How are you doing, David?
Can we get some more chatter in here? I'm doing good. what's been up with you? We'll start with you, Carrington. What's up with you recently?
Birds and clouds, you know, up things. Mostly just setting up the gear for the relaunch of the Monsterfeet site and the video aspect of the 1 MHz thing we were talking about off camera or off mic. So it's taking so long to get all that done. Holy cow, the 1 MHz shows are piling up as I'm trying to get the video aspects recorded. So hopefully, I think about another.
Yeah, you're
month.
Not very efficient. We're gonna have to hire somebody else to do
it's
that.
It's just I'm having to learn a lot about doing lower thirds and just all this video stuff. And holy cow, yeah. So, but it'll come together. Hopefully in a month or
it's
so.
It's very exciting though.
I'm excited.
I know me and all your fans are looking forward to.
It should be good. I was telling you how I've got
wonderful color.
It will be. Well, 1 MHz will still be audio, but it's a totally different show format, more of a variety sort of thing, and it divides up each software. It gets 2 episodes, and then there's the video aspect, which is the unboxing.
Had you said you were going to do any video related to it, though?
Yeah, no, there is. There's a different show that's sort of like a co-show with it that is the unboxing show, where it's and that's all done in videos because there's so much about it that's visual. So that's sort of, and it's that one that's holding up because I've got co-hosts that are not human and I'm having to build them and it's taking a while. Right. So, but my first test today actually worked with one of them. So I've got a co-host and now I just have to finish the second one. So I figured about a month or so it'll launch.
Cool.
Yeah.
So let me ask you on mic, I guess. So were you inspired by Mystery Science Theater 3000 at all for your co-host?
No, I was inspired by an Ontario children's television show from, TVO, anybody who lives in Canada or Ontario, many, many years ago would have heard of a show called Read All About It. And so if you're a Canadian kid from Ontario, you probably know that show. And my co-hosts were sort of inspired by two of the people in that, Theta and Otto. So my own are also called Theta and Otto. So they're based on that instead.
Sounds cool.
Yeah, should be fun.
It's like you can check out Read All About It here on YouTube. I'll have to put a link. So Earl, what's been up with you?
I've had a turbulent week. My computer
really?
Was broken.
Oh,
I hate it when my computer's broken. My main desktop, you know, just decided to get flaky and not boot up and, you know, blue screen and all kinds of stuff. I did everything, you know, reinstall, swapping components. Finally, I had to take it to Fry's because I had a 2-year replacement warranty on the CPU and the motherboard. Turned out it was the CPU.
Wow.
So, believe it or not, I've never had a major component like that fail on me. It was and it was actually really hard to diagnose, but I'm back on my feet now, and my processor grew 2 new cores as a result because they couldn't replace it with the old 6-core that I had, so they had to give me a bulldozer 8-core processor.
Wow.
So
sweet,
my computer can do a bunch of stuff all at once now. So I think it's decided to take over. Actually, it told me it didn't need me anymore.
There was a silver lining in what's up with you, Earl. Get it? Carrington just said clouds, remember?
Yeah. You're off the show, David. That's it. This is now the Earl and Carrington show. Go. Get out.
That's it.
You're on.
All right. Well, before we move into our items of interest in the news, so just in what I'm up to, I've had a real hectic week too, Earl. And me and a guy from our group, the Atlanta Historical Computing Society, we went to a tech fair in Macon, which is 111 miles away. So that, you know, and then, which was fun. We put
was
up
it
a lot
Maker Fair?
No, it was the, it was
Maker Macon. So, that would be awesome.
All the kids that won their science fairs at their, I don't think it was elementary. I think it was just middle school. Yeah. I don't think I saw kids that young. So I think it's primarily middle school and high school. So every kid that won their school's science fair then came to this. For a reason, you know, for the state of Georgia.
Cool.
To compete.
Georgia has science?
Yeah. How's that work? So it was pretty good. I did it last year. Unfortunately, well, there was a downside. It was at a new venue at Macon State College, and they spread it across three buildings, And they actually put us in the building where there was like a cafeteria where people could like rest and eat and stuff. And I think that really limited the number of people that came in versus kind of the main two buildings.
Right.
Where there's actually had the thing set up and judging and everything else. So, but anyway, so just some hectic stuff. I did another episode of Not Another Apple Podcast with Blake.
Mm-hmm.
So
congrats on episode two.
Well, thank you. So that's exciting. And I think coming together, that's about it for me. But really, so moving right into our items, this kind of ties into what we're up to. So one of the things we're all going to be up to, and it's completely set in stone now, is we're all going to Kansas Fest.
We are. Hooray.
I guess we announced that before, but we all have tickets and stuff now.
Well, we don't, because I'm still waiting for Earl's registration stuff.
Yeah, you know, I tried to print out that PDF, and every time I did, it kept crashing Adobe Reader. So no. I've got, you know, and you couldn't save it, because they made it so you can't save it. So
you have to do it on Apple too. You didn't know that.
That's the problem.
Or if you just send
and I
send
don't
me...
have an Apple too, so I guess I'm not going.
Just send me the info, and when I submit our registration thingies, just send me the info, and I'll submit them directly for the three of us, maybe.
Thank you, sir. Yeah,
no problem.
So, but yeah, very much looking forward to Kansas Fest, guys.
Me too.
To meet you guys in person.
I know. I guess it'll be the first time we meet.
Yep. First time in person, we hang out.
The end of this show.
So now there's the optimism for you.
We all meet each other and hate each other. We're like, what the hell? Why am I recording with these bozos? You've met me already.
Have a good time.
That's it. I'm going to swap over and just try to get myself on open Apple instead and be done with you guys.
So let me just talk about Kansas Fest a little bit more. So, me and Earl bought our plane tickets. And so, Carrington, you're riding your motorcycle in.
I am indeed.
So you will be there the whole time. You're going to show up, I guess, Tuesday just in time for supper.
Yep.
It's your plans. And then, Earl, you're showing up actually the morning of Tuesday. So it's on July 17th through July 22nd. Isn't that right, Earl? You're showing up that morning?
Yeah, I got the red-eye flight.
So you're there the whole time. Unfortunately, me, I don't show up till I fly in Wednesday the 18th at around 5 p.m. So it's possible I might miss the keynote. Which would be very unfortunate, but...
Oh, yeah, you probably will, I guess, because it'll be Wednesday. But you're there for the rest of the whole show, right? Or the rest of the whole event.
Oh, so he's going to hang out too, right?
Oh, sure. Well, I'm assuming so. I don't know.
John Romero. That's who we're talking about. He's doing the keynote. Co-founder of...
Maybe. Nobody's seen you and John Romero in the same room. So maybe this is just a story. How long is your hair?
Yeah, it's kind of short.
Oh, then you're not. John's got those flowing locks.
Sort of military looking.
Oh, then definitely not John Romero.
So anyway, and then, you know, even though we'll all be there the whole time, and then I think we're all leaving around the same time, you know, Sunday afternoon. That's when everybody pretty much leaves, right?
Yeah, I'll take off on Sunday.
Right. Even though we're coming, still come anyway. I mean, you know.
Well, I'm hoping it's, I think it should be a good one. Bunch of people are going. John Romero's a great keynote speaker. I mean, if you've been thinking of going, this is the year to go, I think. We're all going to be there. Ken and Mike from Opal Apple are going to be there. No doubt the regular groups of Sheppy et al. Will be there and stuff like that. And just Andy Malloy and you know, great, great people go. And it's a great keynote. So I'm thinking hopefully this will be a big turnout and we'll see. I'm really looking forward to it.
Me too. All right, so moving along then. Well, I started with Kansas Fest because we're all going, but actually there's an earlier event, and so I want to make sure to mention it, the Vintage Computer Festival East, which is happening Saturday and Sunday, May 5th and 6th. And so our buds over at March, the Mid-Atlantic, lost my link here.
Retro Computing.
Help me out.
Hobbyists,
thank you. Are putting that on in Wall, New Jersey at the InfoAge Science Center. And they have a pretty big show going as well. Mm-hmm. So it's like... It may easily be one of the biggest shows they've ever done.
They've got some great speakers coming in.
So what, Daniel Kaki, early employee of Apple, you know, obviously knew the two Steves and was involved very early on. Thomas Kurtz, Dr. Thomas Kurtz, who co-invented BASIC.
Boy, I tell you, I'd give my pinky toe to meet Thomas Kurtz. I really wish I could get to that VCF.
Yeah, I'm going to go. Unless something comes up that weekend where I can't, I've got it on my schedule. I got to go. Like,
ooh,
I think it's the only chance I'm ever going to get to hear him talk, to meet him. So I'm really keen. So unless something comes up where I can't go, I'm heading down because I'm really excited about it.
So there's two keynotes, and those are the two main special guests. I was thinking maybe there's a third kind of big personality coming. But anyway,
it's me.
Yeah, you are now.
My big personality.
All right, so let's move on into our other news and items this week. So, Carrington, you can take it away with the first one.
Let me see. So the first one is an Apple museum has opened up in Moscow. It's not huge, and we'll have a link in the show notes to a site talking about it.
It looks good, though.
It totally looks good. I mean, it doesn't look like it. It really looks like a room. So it's a museum that's a room, but it's well displayed. It's got a bunch of old computers. There's the link we'll have is to a site called RT. I don't know what that site is, but the nice thing is they have a link to a video that you can look at where they sort of they show the site and you can sort of see the way everything's displayed. It's all in these. You know, it's a white room on white tables, so it's very clean looking. And they just have sort of the computers all line up, all working. The nice thing about this is it's not a museum where everything's behind glass and this is like they're right on tables. You can walk around. I don't think you're supposed to interact with them necessarily, but it's a nice looking display, everything looking completely pristine and brand new and a good variety of vintage Apple computers there, all not yellowed.
It says the owner, engineer Andrei Antonov, boasts that most of the machines still work perfectly.
Yep, and they did in the video.
And that just really strikes me as a very Russian name.
Very, very much so, yeah. It's a private collection. It's sort of been now set up as a museum. I don't know if it's been donated to Moscow, so it's a permanent museum or what have you. But basically somebody is – it's not a massive collection, but it looks like a really good quality one.
Yeah,
so
just and good coverage on Apple.
Yeah, so any of our listeners out in Russia or near to Moscow can pop by and take a look.
Okay. What do you got, Earl?
Well, do you guys fear mimes?
Next item.
Because those guys really kind of scare me, you know, with the whole quiet thing and the fake glass. And no, this is a different kind of mime. Sorry.
Or is it mime, just hate them?
The mime standard, actually, for sending attachments, multi-purpose internet mail extension protocol, just turned 20 years old. And so over on Tech Week Europe, they had an interview with the guy who invented this standard, Nathaniel Borenstein. My apologies, because I know since I said it twice, I mispronounced it at least one of those times. And maybe both.
maybe both, yes.
So anyway, they have an interview with him. It was pretty interesting. They were speculating, you know, why did MIME become so popular? How did it get so entrenched? Open standard. And, you know, there was a definite need to be able to send binaries around within the context of messaging. And, of course, you know, now they say we send a trillion MIME attachments per day, which is
just one guy does the spammers.
Yeah, well, you know, in some of the discussion on this on Slashdot, they were saying, yeah, if you cut it down from the spam, it'd probably only be a billion. But there's so much traffic there's only like going on 7 billion people, right? So a trillion attachments a day, that's pretty fantastic. So the article was a good read. Guy's still like in there in the biz and it's got some interesting things to say. So we'll have a link for it up in the show notes.
So what do you guys think about MIME? What's your opinions? Pro, con?
I don't know a lot about it. I mean, I've certainly heard about it and, you know, I'm aware of it, but, so is that still primarily the dominant?
Oh, sure.
Format?
If you're not sending plain mail with an attachment,
everything's
MIME.
Yeah,
absolutely. And you know, on the internet, going web browsing, there's a strong linkage between your browser and the web server in terms of the kind of content that the web server is giving you. It will give you what's called a MIME type, you know, this category of hundreds of different kinds of information that the web server might be telling you, and it's, you know, a way for those things to handshake. I think it's been, you know, critical. What were you going to say, Carrington?
Oh, that I'm not necessarily in favor of it. Like, I'm curmudgeonly
really?
Enough. I mean, I totally get that there was the need, and I get that, you know, and I too now send mail. I'm old school enough that I send plain text mail, but I have accepted that the rest of the world decided that it wanted fax machines instead of modems, and the rest of the world wanted email to be filled with their JPEG logos and all that kind of stuff. I hear a call. Or is that just in my head?
Yeah, that was mine. Sorry. Oh,
is that
podcasting 101? Don't have your phone near the microphone.
I think it was more. That's the 1980s calling, telling me that I got to move into the future. So, like, I've accepted it. I know on like for my the vintage computer stuff, the mail I get from that, I no longer just immediately filter out anything that's not plain text. But part of me still thinks, you know, oh, it was better when we were kids and mail was plain text. But it's just because I'm old and I'm curmudgeonly. So I get it.
Well, I guess most of the time most of the email I'm sending then is it's what, HTML based then, right? Or rich text format would be the alternative?
Yeah, if it's rich text, then it's some sort of MIME stuff. Yeah.
Oh, okay, it still is. I don't.
Well, it could be HTML, right?
Yeah, you got your fancy colors and your links and your flashing GIFs and all. Oh, you should keep off my lawn.
You know, I mean, I miss the days of Pine. Did you ever use Pine, Carrington?
Did I ever? How about this morning? No, but yes, yeah, of course. Yeah.
And yeah, part of what I miss from that, so I'll go with you halfway on this, Carrington. I'll say that I miss the days when the stuff that I got was more content and less, you know, like snazzy looking kind of stuff. Like there's so much time spent in formatting, and I understand presentation is important, but it sure seems like it's the tail wagging the dog sometimes. And I tell you, my boss still sends his email in plain text. I mean, I always know when I got a message from him because it's, you know, in plain courier.
Yep.
And, you know, not fluffy or anything like that, just straight to the point.
Yep.
So
I'm old school that way myself. Even on my business mail, I'm like the only one at any of the companies I work with that is just sending out total plain text mail. I don't have I've got a plain text footer, no logos and stuff. But I have to do the tech support for all the people who have all their fancy logos, who are constantly saying, hey, why didn't it appear? Why can't I see this? And dealing with windmail.txt files. And so.
Yes.
And I've heard of Pine, and I know what it is. I've never used it, and it just makes me think of you're talking about curmudgeons or whatever. But when I first got online, it wasn't until it's a long time ago now, but 1992. But it was on CompuServe, so I had CompuServe email.
Right.
And then when I started collecting computers and looking at Usenet news groups and getting involved in, you know, printing my newsletter and doing stuff like that, and I moved back to the States from Germany, I got on AOL. And I can't tell you how much freaking flack I got all the time because I was the AOL, you know, who was ruining the internet and all that stuff.
Yeah, the internet.
And these people, you know, these Pine users and all these old schoolers just hated AOL and, you know, us. You know, I wasn't guilty of any of the things they complained about. I don't remember what they used to complain about, you know. But
do you still remember your CompuServe user ID number, your email address?
No, I don't. I could find it because I have it. You know, somewhere. I have like an old.
My second most recent ex, like a girl I dated two gals ago, which sounds horrible to even put it that way, but sorry. But I think the reason I fell for her is she remembered her CompuServe. We talk about Vinti stuff. I met her at a party and she rattled off her CompuServe number. I'm like, well, now I'm in love with you. that is so awesome. Like, that you could remember that. That is hardcore old school.
It was like 7 or 8 digits, a period, and then 3 digits, wasn't
it? Yeah, or a comma or something like that. Anyway, she rattles it off, and I don't know if it was accurate or not, but that is the key to a nerd's
Didn't
heart.
Matter.
Say that in the kitchen at a party, AOL. I'm like, I'm sold. Yeah, totally.
When I got on AOL, if I remember correctly, so this is like, I'm thinking that, I don't know, sometime late 93 or early 94, they only had like 300 or 400,000 members. And you know how that grew, right? In their
heyday.
Then
you got on there, and everyone came over, had to be near David.
But my name then was historical@AOL.com.
Ooh.
Ooh. Very nice. You should have kept that one.
Well, I did for the longest time. That's all.
Everyone, you can email David at historical@AOL.com.
Oh, don't do that. Don't do that.
Actually, we email that person anyway. They'll be like, why am I getting all this mail?
Actually, I had stopped using it, moved on to me.com, you know, a mobile me or
Mac. And you will soon have to move on again.
Yeah, right. iCloud
now.
You
get your own domain name, dude. Like, I got burned a couple times and finally gave up and said, that's it.
David at ConstantComputing.com.
Yeah.
Now, I've got a bunch of email addresses now. But someone finally, I kept that for the longest time at AOL, didn't use it. And then someone hacked it in like 2007, took it over. And then and then I changed the path. I went back and forth a bunch of times and had a real hard time with AOL, and I finally had to, you know, it was a free account, but I finally had to kill the account off and just close it down.
My favorite email address I've ever had is I used to have an account on io.org. It was a local Canadian company, and they were just io.org, and I got the email address C. So I was just c@io.org. It was the shortest and most memorable one I ever had, and they closed down. And otherwise, I would, because it looked like chow. It was awesome, right? So I loved it. So I was just c. But most places you can't get a one digit email address. Like, they won't give you just the letter C. But I used to love it. It was the only time I got something that short, and I had it for ages. So, oh well.
So, Carrington, you have the microphones. Go ahead and take it away.
I'm going
to
rock it. Mapsdelgia. Oh, okay. So this is something that's been around for a while, but I hadn't heard about it. It's a Tumblr. So all the kids today like their Tumblrs. And it's called Mapsdelgia. It's curated by a fellow named Joss Millard. And what the idea is, you draw video game maps from memory, and then you submit them, and he posts them. So if you can remember, like, for instance, Ninja Gaiden's out there, and XCOM, but you might remember, like, an Infocom map, or some other text adventure, or something like that. The idea is to sit down, and using whatever tools you want, but ideally just pen and paper, and you draw everything you can remember from a video game map, and then you just post it. It's not about accuracy. It's maybe you remember almost nothing, but you might remember, oh, here's where the secret door was, or here's where you find the candle, or here's you got to jump, or that kind of stuff. And then you just post it, and it's a really fun site to go through, because I would think myself, I doubt I could accurately do any video game map. But when I went through this Tumblr, I would see things, and it would immediately make me remember the game. I'd be like, oh yeah, right, and I would spot incorrect things, and so locked in our brains somewhere are these maps. And it's a really interesting approach to see, like, you know, what can you dredge up from memory from a game that you either loved or just played once or played recently or what have you. It's all on the honor system, so maybe people will play through or cheat or what have you. But for the most part, you can sort of tell people aren't cheating because there's a lot of vagaries. It's a really fun site. So if you're interested in vintage gaming, it's just sort of another approach and another way to sort of capture that community. It's a really fun site. So it's just a mapstelgia.tumblr.com. But we'll have a link in the show notes.
Yeah, that looks pretty neat. Yeah. Some of the artwork, it's interesting seeing the different way, you know, different versions of artwork. And
totally, because some people are really professional and they do it, and some people are just, you know, roughly doing it with pen and different ways. It's sort of because it reflects the way people are remembering the game, so in the way you sort of internally visualized it. So it's really fun. It's a really fun site.
Well, here's a question for you too. I've certainly heard of Tumblr, and I'm certain I've been on some Tumblr sites, but okay, what is it?
Why quick blogs. Think of Tumblr as
different?
Twitter with a lot more characters. So it's a not microblogging site, but it's a fast blogging site. So we have a Tumblr, it's just like you can it's sort of like, think of StumbleUpon, but you've got your own site. So you would just have your Tumblr, and you can just post things. And anybody on Tumblr, you can sort of subscribe to others. So you can – it's like a blogger site. It's very similar to Blogger, but more oriented towards very rapid dissemination of things and ideas. And people can set up stuff like this where it's acting as half wiki, half blog for a group of people. And you can submit it, and he just puts up the item. So just think of it as a blog with extra linking social features.
Okay. I've always wondered.
Yeah.
Cyril, you take it now. Did Microsoft's basic licensing kill the Apple IIe?
Well, so over on the Apple II history site, and, you know, Carrington, David, check me on the pronunciation. I guess I'll probably meet Stephen at, you know, hopefully he'll be there at Kansas Fest, right? Mm-hmm. Is it Weyrich?
Yeah. I think he will be.
Weyrich. And Dr. Steve, you can call
Weyrich.
Him. Dr. Steve.
Dr. Steve, that's easy.
Yeah, I've always said Weyrich because, of course, I never knew him.
You know what?
Personally.
Maybe it is Weyrich. You know, you think I would know. No, I roomed with him at Kansas Fest.
I think it's Weyrich. I think it's – how did you say it, Carrington?
Weyrich? I said Steve. Steve. Just Steve.
Weyrich. Yeah, I think
– Dr. Steve.
Yeah. Steve. Doc. Call him Doc. Great.
Pronounce things in your head, and then that's how you know it, and then it's hard to change it until, you know, someone tells you correctly and you have the chance to say it a number of times. So.
Right.
But anyway, I think
– I hear he's going to be putting together a book.
He's actively working on it. He's been actively collecting submissions of things when he comes up with stuff lately. I've been reading a lot of that where he'll say, hey, does anyone have a photo or scan of this and that sort of thing. And he's been soliciting stories right now, personal stories about the use of the Apple II and modern use of the Apple II for the last chapter of the book. I'm really excited about his forthcoming book. So.
Awesome. So over on his site, there's a blog entry, and it speculates whether or not there was a financial implication when the Apple IIe was discontinued. I think that was 1993. You know, probably the product was approaching the end of its life anyhow, but there's a possibility that it was a confluence of events that led to its discontinuance, including the end of a licensing agreement with Microsoft for their Microsoft Basic that was in the Apple IIe. And apparently they got that license agreement way back, you know, in antiquity, 1977 or something like that. There was the original Integer Basic on the Apple II. And did Apple create that themselves? It seems
I think that was Wozniak. Yeah.
Yeah. And so then the floating point BASIC came from Microsoft, like with so many of the computers of that era.
Right.
And, you know, way back then, Microsoft wasn't terribly concerned about the 6502. But as time went on and some of the popularity of the 6502 machines went through the roof, they became increasingly interested in this. And so it's possible that the termination of that agreement was the one of the final straws that led Apple to say, oh, okay, it's time for the Apple II to sing its swan song, at least the Apple IIe, that is. And also, there's a link there to Commodore and how they did their licensing with Microsoft. From what I read, they got a really good deal with Microsoft. They strongly negotiated for the 6502 BASIC that they had. And because the reason the Commodore 64 had such a crummy BASIC is because Commodore didn't want to go back and redo that licensing agreement. So they stuck the same BASIC technology in subsequent models of the Commodore computer and didn't change that until, you know, more into the future. But so the Commodore 64 probably was cheap because they got such a good deal on that, but the Apple IIe might have hit its demise because of the end of that licensing agreement. So, you know, that interesting effect of Microsoft BASIC on all these different computers.
Microsoft BASIC definitely had a huge effect. I'm a little dubious about this being the actual – I think it might have been a contributing factor because it definitely lines up time-wise. But one of the comments on the Apple II history site does point out the fact that, like, the 2E card – continued past that, and it would have had the same info in there, and so I'm not really aware of the timelines, but I suspect maybe it was one of the contributing factors. Though there would be the cost, there would still be the cost of renewing it for various things, and maybe when they got the 2E card, it was a different license. Who knows? Because it is suspiciously bang on that time. So
technically, the 2E card could have been a different product.
Exactly.
You know, it's a different.
Yeah, like who knows how the licensing worked or what have you. So, but you know, it's suspiciously coincidental if it wasn't at least a contributing factor, because the timelines really line up. It's just really neat sort of detective work there by Steve to try to track this down. So it's cool.
You know, I never quite at least I hadn't thought about it before. I didn't fully realize that Apple canceled the 2GS a year before the. So in other words, the 2E was the last surviving Apple II. Mm-hmm. Why would they kill the 2GS off before the 2E?
I think it's just not selling, and so you don't keep manufacturing it. It drops to levels where they say it's not worth making these.
Sold in schools, I guess, huh? Maybe.
Yeah, the 2E just was crazily popular and just stuck around. I mean, I remain a 2E guy. I always preferred my 8-bit Apples over the 2GS. I had a 2GS, but I just never loved it the same way. And nowadays, I find that I personally use the 8-bit Apple stuff far more. I use the 2GS when it's a 2GS game in particular, like Task Times at Hometown or something like that. But otherwise, I'm totally a 2E and 2C kind of guy.
The 2E, do you have as a platinum? Or is it the 2E enhanced? Or?
I have an enhanced and a platinum in my closet. I'm going to give away one of them because I don't need that. I'm just not a collector. I don't need that many 2Es. I used to have a 2C, but I gave that one away already, and now I'm sort of missing it, and I'd like a 2C plus because I never had one. So if I pick up a 2C plus, I will get rid of probably the 2E platinum. Because I grew up with the non-extended keyboard Apple, in my mind, I prefer that. I prefer the one without I prefer the non-platinum. I like the look, the color of the platinum, but I don't like having the number keys that off-center my keyboard. I'm OCD enough to prefer my keyboard right in the middle, so I want my spacebar centered. So it's really more about that. It really just and if I want the numerical keypad, you can get a little external one. So I would have that if I wanted it, which I really don't. So I have an enhanced 2E, and that's my go-to 2E. And I've got a 2GS and the platinum that just sort of sit in a closet.
Well, so moving along, we're going to go to the next item here, which is a Space Invaders couch, which is pretty darn cool looking. Have you guys looked at this?
Mm-hmm.
It's $5,000, which is like...
I'm only going to buy the two. Because that's so expensive. It's so ridiculous.
Yeah, right. But if you're one of the first 10 customers, you get it shipped free, which is a savings of $300. But that just... You know, my first... It is so cool looking. I think it's awesome cool looking. So it's crazy expensive, though. But, you know, my other comment is I'm looking at it. It's like the framework, I'm assuming. Does it describe what it's made out of? But it says it's memory foam cushions. But I'm assuming it's some type of... It could be wood painted white, right? Or it could be metal. It could be plastic.
I think it's either MDF or plastic is probably what it's made out of. It doesn't say. I wonder how comfortable it would be. But it's striking
looking.
See,
that's my thing. Maybe this is an ignorant thing. Because, what, it's a piece of art that's meant to be looked at? I have a big thing about functionality, that form follows function. And so if you're sitting on this and you try to put your arms up on the cushions, you know, your arm should sort of gently sink into the cushion and your arm can rest on it. But if you've got that hard, you see what I'm saying, along the inside of the couch, there's
totally.
the white. Yeah, that's going to be hard on your arm.
But
you know,
I think this is a couch you have when
you've
got space to have your lounging couch, and this is a separate couch, or you're going for a very modern look. I mean, it's cool, though. It definitely doesn't look like any other couch I've ever seen.
No, it looks great. You can look at it from different angles.
Yep.
You found this, Carrington. Where did you find it at?
You know, I don't even know. It's just floated around someplace on some design blog. I'm interested in design and stuff, and I've been thinking of redecorating. So I have my place right now is very, very modern. I've gone with a sort of 1950s or late 1960s pop look. Instead of a coffee table, I got orange cubes and that kind of stuff. So I was just looking at things, but
cool.
I'm thinking of switching to something, you know, a different era sort of. You know, you get bored, you want to redecorate. Like, you know, welcome to the life of a single person. So, and so I know on some sort of design blog, I guess I saw a link, and I was like, oh, Space Invaders couch. I am not purchasing that.
You know, it's a time frame, and actually I'm looking at my bookshelf, and I have a book that I really like. This particular book's more about the home style itself, but generally people decorate them in the same sort of style. But it's maybe this is a very American thing too. But anyway, the book's called Atomic Ranch.
Yeah, see, you could name my place an Atomic Ranch. Like that's how I look. I've got lots of pop art. I basically tried to decorate like Emma Peel would be comfortable here. Like that was the thinking. So from the Avengers. So if she came in, she would say, "Yeah, I hang out here." So.
Okay.
That was the thinking behind the design choices I made this time. So.
I mean, that's good, because if that were ever to happen...
I'd be a very happy guy.
it'd be pretty cool.
Well, but what you're describing sounds to me more like mid-60s. Probably say this is... Some of these styles are more mid to late 50s.
Yeah, no, I definitely went more 60s and real Italian sort of look to a lot of the stuff, and the very swoopy plastic bits and lots of splashes of color, but mixed in with primarily black and white and stuff. And so, yeah, that's just sort of how I went, in case people are interested in how I have decorated my content.
Definitively late 70s, early 80s, though.
Yeah. Oh, I think so. This couch itself is you know, I would think 80s, because I'm thinking it goes with 1979 or whatever with your Space Invaders machine. But it's cool looking.
It's a real dandy.
But $5,000 for a couch? I don't think so.
Yeah. But it's a piece of art.
Yeah, whatever. It's for my butt. I prefer a couch you can lean on. I like to read on my couch, so I want the sides to not be so angular. I like to lean back a bit and lie with your iPad and read. So I want a couch that's functional as well as nice looking.
So our next link looks like it might be a little related. It's called a Tallgrass 8-Bit Pale Ale.
So speaking of leaning back. So Tallgrass is a brewing company, and they had a contest or something where they're asking people what is the next beer they should put out, and overwhelmingly people said put out an 8-bit beer. So they have put out a beer that's an 8-bit, I guess 8-bit label. I don't know how the beer itself would be 8-bit, but it's an 8-bit label.
Yeah.
And to promote it, they made a really funny YouTube video sort of promoting this new 8-bit beer done in sort of puppet style, emulating a side-scroller video game. And it's fun because in it they make fun of themselves. They don't call it tall grass. They drop the G at the end. And like, I liked that it's a company that had that much of a sense of humor and is willing to promote this way. So I sort of want to promote it. I've never had the beer, but I'm Canadian, so I'm in favor of beer. And I just really like the sensibility of this. And I love it. You know, it's got a retro theme to it, and it's a really, really fun video to watch for the promotion of a beer. I know it's a big commercial, but it's hilarious.
Is it a Canadian microbrew?
No, I've never heard of them before. I think they're in the States. Just Canadians. You know, we're just sort of globally aware of beer.
Sore Portlandians.
Oh, look, they have T-shirts. If you go to their website, press start for 8-bit. They have you know, 8-bit looking T-shirts. Oh, that's pretty cool.
8-bit stuff, the nostalgia stuff is hitting hard lately in a lot of industries, including, it would seem, beer.
Such mainstream appeal, don't you think?
Yep.
They are in Manhattan, Kansas, my friends.
Well, the 80s are sort of back big time.
Kansas.
Hey, really? Hold on.
This sounds like a field trip.
It sounds like something to bring into Kansas Fest then.
I don't know if they allow beer on the school campus.
allow, whatever.
Is that true, really?
Beer in the dorms, probably not. I'm thinking.
In the dorms?
Darn them.
What?
Just saying.
Hey, I
got the map here. So Manhattan is... Okay, check it out. Manhattan is outside of Topeka, and Topeka is to the west of Kansas City.
So they're in Kansas, not in Missouri?
We'd be transporting across
state lines. That appeals to me even more. I feel like a bootlegger.
I'm trying to see what's what here, but it looks like... So, let's see, 20, 40. It looks like they're about 60 miles or 150 kilometers west of Kansas City. We should go.
Totally.
Yeah, we got other things to do.
Do we?
Look, the guy's fighting the 8-bit keg or whatever.
Are you watching the video? Yeah, it's fine.
Well, I just went back over to that site.
It's very funny because then he fights it and then he sort of has to – he gets killed. He has to restart. It's a funny video. It's really well done with a little puppet.
Well, guess what, Carrington? It's all you, the rest of the links here.
Bring it.
Yeah, take us out, man.
Thanks a lot.
me. Okay, so the next thing we want to talk about is I actually got this. This was forwarded to us by Ken Gagne, I think, who wants to get mentioned in every one of our episodes, it would seem. So I'm pretty sure he's the one who brought this to my attention anyway. Wastelands.
Or is it Gagne?
It should be Gagne, yes, but it's not. It's Gagne. So it's Wasteland 2 is coming. I am quite excited about this. So it'll be a new version of Wasteland. The original Wasteland is a game I played not too long ago and reviewed in 1 MHz, and I adored it. It was one of the best gaming experiences I have ever had. I can't express how much I enjoyed that game. And it was the precursor to the Fallout series, which is, you know, still going on now. And so you could say, in a sense, we already have Wasteland 2 in Fallout. But this is an actual, you know, direct sequel. They're going to make it isometric, it seems. So it won't be in a first-person view, much more retro. And the goal, he says, on the site is supposedly it'll be as if you play Wasteland and then you go into Wasteland 2, you should be picking right up from where you left off. He's talked about, like, you know, what sort of features do you want, and bandied around on the forum, a lot of people are saying, well, then you should have an importer. I should be able to import my characters from the first Wasteland, because why not? Like, a lot of people play it in emulators, and the character files are very readable because there's lots of little hacking games out there that will modify your characters, so somebody knows this. So hopefully, if they don't have direct importing, I'm hoping somebody comes out to a patch for the game that lets you read, say, a vintage Apple disk image with your characters and then changes your characters in this game to be the same characters, because that would be awesome. So anyway, like it says on the site, my mind has exploded like a blood sausage. I am over the moon excited about this game. So can't wait. It'll probably suck.
Speaking of Kid Gagning, I think they talked about it. I just listened to the new Open Apple. I'm pretty sure they were talking about it.
I don't admit that I listened to that, although I listened to it too. Yeah, they talked about it.
But I'm looking real quick on Kickstarter, because I think, isn't this where they funded a lot of it? It was on Kickstarter? Darn it.
All I know is In Exile.
You guys know?
Did that reboot of the Baldur's Gate game and something else recently, Demon's Forge. Because I have the original Apple II Demon's Forge, but I haven't I think I mentioned it on our show once, but I haven't actually played that yet. And the new Demon's Forge was supposed to be awful. Just got panned. A terrible, terrible game. So I am quite concerned that since the same people were behind it in Exile, what they're going to do is put out a completely terrible game called Wasteland 2. So I hope that that's not going to be the case. But for now, I'm going to be optimistic and really excited because I loved Wasteland. Like, without limit. I cannot express how much I enjoyed playing that game. How good that game is. Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry, well, just want to make sure everybody knows. Moving on. You know what?
Sounds
okay,
cool.
So this last one is just a quick mention of another game for the Apple II. It's a new game, Brian Pitchy. I found this game in the new forum, and it's a way for me to bring up the game and also to bring up the fact that, like we mentioned last episode, we're playing around in the forum over on the Vintage Computer forum. So people should join in and give feedback maybe there, talk about the show and that sort of stuff. There'll be links in the show notes, of course. So in that forum, because I'm now participating and hanging out, I got to find out about the game Dogfighters of Mars, which is a very simple side-scrolling game using low-res graphics for the Apple II, but it's fun. And the developer first posted it and then used an Apple... It's in AppleSoft Basic, and it got compiled. Use a basic compiler to speed it up, and now it's crazy fast. There's a YouTube link, which is, I guess, what we're linking to, and so you can see the game in action. And from the YouTube site, we'll have links where you can download the actual game if you want to play it yourself on an actual Apple II or on an emulator. So just a fun, very basic side-scrolling game. And just an example of how somebody could sit down. I think he said it took him about 8 hours, half of which was debugging. And just it's a basic game, really simple. But it's a nice example of how you can sit down and in an afternoon knock out a nice, fun, retro side-scrolling laser game with a great name, I think. So and a way to bring up the fact that you should hang out in these forums because you get to find out neat things like this.
Yeah, and there's plenty of activity in the forums too, not just about our podcast. So about all kinds of different platforms and other
totally.
Topics.
And collections and people have questions and that kind of stuff. It's a nice way. If you're interested in the sorts of things we talk about in this podcast, I honestly think you would be interested in the sorts of things they're talking about in that forum. It's the same thing, but much more interactive. And that's it.
Coolio.
That's all I got. That's what I got to share.
Well, then we'll share some more in a different way, moving along to the retro computing gift ideas.
Ooh.
Well, this is something we're going to try to make a regular thing. I think it gets difficult, or we just need to prep more.
But I'm really interested in this device that you picked.
I got one as a gift recently.
Does he have to keep talking, Earl?
I do. Me. I'm muting you both. So,
all right, go ahead.
A good friend of mine, such a lovely person, gave this to me as a gift. She said, I found this, and I thought of you, and it's awesome. So it's by NeuerTech. There's a few other versions. There's a very similar device available on ThinkGeek, for instance. I'm linking to the NeuerTech version because that's the one that I have, and so I can speak from experience that is amazing. So it's the NeuerTech Universal Drive Adapter. And if – like, I'm the sort of person who – I don't hang on to computers much – but I did have a ton of drives lying around that I couldn't get rid of. And sometimes I kept thinking, I've got to put that in the case because I'm not sure what's on it and I haven't labeled it and I'd like to get rid of it or destroy it or something because I don't want to just – but maybe there's something on it I need. And so this is just a little sort of universal cable. It's a small black box that takes a mainline power and has a few little adapter plugs. But essentially it can plug directly into any SATA or ATA drive. 3.5 inch or 2.5 inch or disk drives as well, and it has just little dongle adapter cable, so you just plug it directly into the bare drive, and then it converts it over to USB, and the drive just mounts. And I used it just 2 days ago to connect a whole bunch of old drives. I had a couple of network drives lying around, and just a mix of things. And just you plug them in, you plug in your computer, and bingo, it mounts. It's perfect. Don't need to put it in a case or anything. So it's a great thing to have in a retro computing tool case. So you ever come across a bare drive, you don't need anything else. Like, this is a fully self-contained way to connect any sort of drive ever to a modern computer. And it's I think, you know, $30 or something, and
yeah,
really, really well worth it. Similar price for a very similar item available on ThinkGeek, mm-hmm. but I haven't used that one, and I did use this NeuerTech one, which is available from Mac Sales, Otherworld Computing. Works with Macs or PCs and stuff as well, works with other computers. Completely works a treat, great instructions come with it, but it's really, really simple, and I loved it. I'm one of the best gifts I've been given in ages, so I'm passing it on.
Yeah, it's interesting that it's USB 3, which is good. And at first I was sitting here going, oh, you mean it's limited to USB 3, but it's not.
But of course it also works under USB 1.1 and USB 2 as well. Like, I don't have USB 3.
Which obviously is very important, you know, for a lot of people.
Yeah, just works great. Just plug it in the drive and bingo, it mounts. So you just eject the drive and you can plug in a different one. I went through like a dozen drives in 20 minutes and just great to help me catalog them and find out which ones I can get rid of and which ones I have to keep, and recovered a whole bunch of data. It was fantastic device. $30, really well spent. Loved it.
Nice.
Well, I didn't have to spend. I got it as a gift. Woohoo.
So how about you, Earl? And I keep hearing this Raspberry Pi brought up kind of regularly lately.
Yeah, I mean, like this isn't stuff. It isn't retro. It feels retro to me. That is, the purpose of this device. Well, first, let me tell you what it is. And I'm reading straight off their site. It's a credit card sized computer that plugs into either your TV or an HDMI monitor and a keyboard. And it's a complete computer. It's about the size of a credit card. It's an ARM-based device with, I think, a system on a chip. It's got Ethernet. It's got USB. Boots off of an SD card. Runs a specially crafted version of Fedora Linux, from what I understand. And can run other things, too. I mean, it's a full ARM-based computer, so the sky's the limit in terms of you know, what software you could write for it. The purpose of the device is what feels retro to me. Interesting thing about this device, it sells for $35 plus shipping. So incredibly low price for a full-fledged computer. And a big purpose of the device is education. People are talking about getting them for their kids to learn programming. And it just takes me back to the day when you would get something like a Timex Sinclair or a VIC-20 or one of the other low-cost computer options back then, and you would get it just to dabble and program and kind of learn how computers worked. You know, I mean, so much of what we do today, I mean, my kids are both computer savvy but don't have an awful lot of understanding what's going on under the hood. My daughter's starting to pick up programming. She actually absconded with my Commodore SX64 and is doing, you know, programming in BASIC and Turtle Graphics, which I think is cool. She's loving it. And so this Raspberry Pi device is something reminiscent of this. You get it, you learn about computers, and, you know, it's $35, so almost anybody could afford one.
Yeah. One thing funny, too, is if you go to the site and you scroll down to, like, it looks like the last posting someone did on March 9th, it says that
no, I just look at
it's
that.
Momentarily more popular than Lady Gaga trending on Google. The Raspberry Pi. That's kind of funny, isn't it?
Yep. I mean, and the thing was just wildly popular on Twitter. And
I've heard it mentioned a bunch lately.
I missed it completely. I have to admit, this is news to me. I'm like, I'm reading this. I'm like, what is this thing? This is awesome.
Seriously?
Yeah,
totally. Oh, my gosh. This has been everywhere.
I live in a hole, a little mole hole. I don't know how I've missed this, but this is fantastic. The store at the moment is down for maintenance. Otherwise, I'd be ordering one right now.
Oh, I seriously want one. I'm getting one like ASAP.
And I guess there's a Model A and a Model B. And
want the Model B because it's got Ethernet.
And also more RAM as well, I guess it looks like, reading stuff.
But
I can't actually order at the moment, but this looks awesome.
And even if you could order, it would probably still be a month or two before you got it. Because
so you should order one and display it at Kansas Fest. This could be your Kansas Fest.
I should have it before Kansas Fest. That's true. And I wonder even if you could get a Linux version of an Apple II emulator to build and run on this thing.
But people at Kansas Fest, a lot of non-Apple things are also like displayed and talked about and stuff like that because it's basically just for yes. we're letting Earl come, even though he stinks of Commodore.
Oh, yeah, I got it on me. Oh. It's all over me.
That doesn't come out, man.
So yeah, Raspberry Pi, great gift idea because it's only $35 plus shipping.
And a good site. I'm reading through the FAQ and it even answers like, will it blend? Will it overclock? It's awesome.
But don't get it if you need it next week because that
I do. I do need it next week. I need it now.
All righty. So moving along. So the last item Frankly, I had to rush a little bit, and I was talking about this at the show that we went to. We just played old computers. And what I do is I set up my Flashback 2, and I also have a Flashback 1. But the Flashback 2 is a great system. I guess, you know, it's just an Atari 2600, like, reproduction with 40 games in it. And it brings the kids over, and so they'll play the old retro games. And it brings some attention and brings people over. So, and then people are like, wow, this is great. Where do you get it and stuff? And I would be telling them about, well, they announced the Flashback 3 recently. So this is basically my gift idea is the Atari Flashback 3. So it's just an updated version of Flashback 2. So now it has 60 built-in games.
Oh, nice. Okay, I was going to ask what the difference is. I have an original Flashback, but I never picked up the 2.
Yeah, no, your Flashback, it looks more like the 7800 console.
Right, which disappoints me.
And it has kind of controls. Yeah, and actually there was, I don't remember all the details. There's quite a bit of disappointment with the system. I like it, but, you know, I'm not a hardcore person about it, I guess, but I think the biggest complaint wasn't so much the look, even though people, I think, prefer the 2600 and the classic joysticks, but that the games were emulated, and with right. The Flashback 2 and the 3, they're actually the real games.
Nice, much better,
if I'm not mistaken, put in there, so.
I've sort of been wanting a Flashback 2 for ages, and I would forget about it, right, but with the 3 out, that's something I'll probably want to pick up. I like the Flashback whole idea. Like, it's so convenient. Mm-hmm. It's like that thing I talked about last week where you just have one little tiny box and it just opens up a bunch of games. But here you don't even need cartridges. And I know that's a downside. Like, if you want to play actual carts, it's much more fun to have a real one. But if you don't have space and you live like in a little condo like I do, having something like a Flashback lets you pick up an actual Atari joystick and play actual Atari games without having to have a massive collection of carts or a big machine. And it works with modern TV, so it's really easy to hook up. And you know, a lot of real advantages to the Flashback. I'm excited. I want a Flashback. I want to have everything on our gift list.
Well, this can kind of be for people that are, you have collectors, and maybe you have people who are just nostalgic or retro, or and just enjoy gaming. They like all kinds of varied gaming from even the earliest types of it.
That's me.
But yeah, there's a lot more work involved, a lot more upkeep and everything else to own a real 2600 and all the games.
I mean, it's fun to have that. I've got in a closet, I've got a heavy sixer, so I do have one of the few old vintage computer or vintage gaming systems that I actually collected and kept.
Would you call it a heavy sixer?
A heavy sixer is one of the really heavy, that's what they're called, the six switch old 2600, like the original one with the metal base, and they weigh quite a bit. It's the more collectible model, so they're called a heavy sixer. So when you're looking for a vintage 2600, you want to get the six switch one and that kind of stuff. So it doesn't really make a big difference, but I went and got one of those, and it's one of the few vintage gaming systems that I actually hung on to. A lot have passed through my hands, and because I really don't hold on to stuff, but there's some reason I like having that one, and I've got a few carts. But frankly, I'm much more likely to play on something like a Flashback because it's a pain to go and drag that thing out of the closet and hook it up, whereas a Flashback can just be kept right near a TV and it's really tiny and just plug it in and you're done. It's like the same way that those little self-contained old video game systems that are just games and a bunch of joysticks. Those things.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of those things because it's so convenient. Yeah, I love those. Those are the sort of things to bring to Kansas Fest, I think. I love those things because it's so convenient, and they're just small and they take up no space, no maintenance. You just plug it in, you play. When you're done, you unplug it and you just stick it in a drawer. And it's really tiny. So I love this sort of thing. So I'm a big, big, big fan.
So certainly I think, you know, gaming falls into, you know, it's retro computing, you know. Mm-hmm. Gaming is obviously a part of that. You know, console gaming slightly different, but, you know, whatever. It's still a great retro gift. And I think
we
embrace the console gaming, retro console gaming a little bit too.
Mm-hmm. As a consultant, Leanne Bryant relies on a lot of things to help her test new outdoors equipment. Experience, knowledge, strength, and CompuServe. She joined CompuServe when she started her own business and found ways to work smarter. Through CompuServe, she meets other experts in her field. She books her own travel to save time, and she stays a step ahead of the weather. And when she has a question about software, CompuServe has the answer. For more information about CompuServe, call 1-800-554-4046. Start with the basics, like news, travel, and encyclopedia, and more, for just $8.95 a month. Then go beyond. For free software and help with hardware and software problems. And you'll agree with Leanne that CompuServe is like the outdoors. The more you see, the more you like. CompuServe, the information service you won't outgrow.
Yeah, I'd like to buy this $1,200 computer.
That'll be $5,300 complete.
$5,300?
What with monitor, software, disk drive,
etc., etc.
Oh.
How much is that $1,000 computer?
$4,400.
Uh-huh. How much is that $1,400 computer?
$3,900.
No, Max. The $1,400 is $4,800. The $600 is $3,900.
I thought the $1,100 was $4,800.
Some computer companies give you a lot of options. K-Pro gives you a complete computer for $1,295.
I think we're going a little long today, so we'll kind of be quick with the look back at the auctions. So Carrington, you had the rare ZipChip 8000 for Apple II Plus, and it sold,
but I'm surprised it only sold for $128.50. I thought it would go for much more because it's the ZipChip, it's the 8000 version. The ZipChip Plus mm-hmm. can go in the 2C, so it's one of the few options you have to speed up an actual 2C, and these things usually sell for a lot more. So there were only four bids, and some lucky guy picked up for, I mean, still $128, it's not pocket change. It's a lot of money to put towards speeding up a computer you can probably buy for $20. Yeah. But
you know,
if
it's
you
not
are looking.
Crazy money.
Yeah, but
if
exactly,
you really love
yes.
your Apple II and you're really going to play with it a lot, then it's not that much, really.
Yeah, and it was fully working and that kind of stuff, and it came with the – I mean, it's even sort of collectible. It came with the original box, and it had the manual and all of that. So I honestly thought that this was going to go for, you know, three times that, but so be it. Somebody got themselves a deal, I think. So well done them.
So next was my choice, the Processor Technology Sol 20, and it sold for $1,000. With 20,
I knew that thing would sell.
Yeah, I think I predicted it would go for more than it was, like at 400 and something at the time.
Yeah.
So, $1,000, I think.
Not surprised.
Yeah, that's not, you know, crazy a lot. It's, you know, not cheap either. So, but not bad. So next, Earl, we'll go to your item, the vintage Epson QX10. So it also sold for $154.01.
Yes, it did.
Which isn't too bad, really. I mean,
no, that's a fine price. It was more than I was willing to spend.
Yeah,
I bid on that one. I got outbid.
Did you bid?
Yeah, I bid on that one. I even bid just a little bit more than I was originally willing to bid. But it's funny, too, because I've been tweeting with the guy who bought it.
Oh, yeah?
So, yeah.
Convince him to go to an event you're going to and to bring it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I'll take good care of it for you. Yeah, $154 is not a terrible high price for a QX10. They hardly ever, and it's funny, it's one of the things that he mentioned in the tweets, is that you hardly ever see these on eBay, especially full complete systems. I mean, occasionally you'll just see the system itself, but not the monitor and the keyboard. And it has a special monitor, so it's not really all that helpful to have the console without having the monitor. So this was good with the software and the books and everything like that. So $154 was a decent price, I think.
Yep.
Yeah, I just did this quick search, and there's not one currently on eBay either. So.
Yeah, that's a sweet system.
All right, so moving along to our current auctions. Carrington, you're going to go first with the Smith Corona Messenger module, which I just want to mention is interestingly being sold by the Commodore user.
Well, it was sort of promoted and a little more popular with Commodore people, but it works with a lot of different vintage computers, including for us Apple guys. It's the kind of thing that rarely comes about, but at the moment, strangely, there are two of them. I linked to one that it's a buy it now for $30, but there's another one right now with just $16.95. It's got
no
a couple
bids.
Days left, and we'll see, but and no bid, so you could pick one up for cheaper. So what the Smith Corona Messenger module is, I have one. I read about it years ago, and I had a standing eBay watch for it, and finally one came up, and I snagged it, and then they went away, and now they seem to be coming back for some reason. So Smith Corona had a series of typewriters called the Messenger series. There was the
I had one.
Yeah, okay, and so the back of it's got a port. It looks like it's like a little serial port. And the Messenger module is the thing that lets you use a Messenger typewriter as a computer printer. I love mine. So I've got a 450, I think it is the something, four something, is my little electric typewriter. You can use it as an actual typewriter, but if you have the Messenger module, you can hook it up to an Apple II or a Commodore and then use it as a printer. So your typewriter just types on its own and you just put in the paper and you print. And the nice thing is it's a way to get, if you like the look and the clacky sound of a daisy wheel typewriter or daisy wheel printer, it's hard to come by still working good daisy wheel printers. Like if you have an Apple II guy like I am, you can search high and low to try to find a working good looking functional Apple II daisy wheel printer. They just don't come around. Whereas you can very, very cheaply pick up a fully functioning the Diablo ones are still around, so if people are looking, I would suggest a Diablo one. But if you're looking, you can get a Smith Corona Messenger typewriter. One of the advantages of those is the ribbons are still manufactured. So if you pick up a Messenger typewriter from Smith Corona, you can buy yourself new ribbons still today. So it's a printer that can be used vintage, looks great, it's letter quality, but you can keep using it. You don't have to worry about the ribbons going away, which is the thing that's killing a lot of old printers, is you just can't find the consumables. And these exist. So for very cheaply, you can pick up these Messenger typewriters very cheap. Sometimes, you know, $5, $10, $20 at most or so. And you pick up one of these Messenger modules, so $40 all in, you have a daisy wheel printer and a typewriter, and it's cool, it looks different. People look at your typewriter and it starts typing on its own. So there's a neatness to it. So I really like it. So but a lot of people don't know about the Messenger module. And what the guy I bought it from on eBay then sent me a message afterwards saying, thanks for buying this thing. What is it? What have I just sold you? I don't even know what it was. So a lot of people don't know about this. And so I thought I'd bring it to people's attention. So there's two opportunities right now to pick up one on eBay. And it's something I have and really enjoy. So I recommend it.
Nice.
Yeah.
So moving along, let's see. So Earl, you go ahead. You're next.
Well, I have my auction is a Mach 20 upgrade for an IBM PCXC. Either way, you guys ever use one of these?
I did.
No, so it's just a processor guard. Okay.
Yep. So it takes a PCXT and it turns it into a 286 machine.
And I mean to cut you off, Carrington. So you did.
I did. I had it exactly for that. My XT got upgraded to a 286 using like this exact card.
Hmm.
Really funny, you know, one of the I think embarrassments of my life. I went to the 1987, I think it was, or 88 COMDEX, and the buzz there was OS2. Everybody was talking about OS2. OS2 was going to take over the world.
Was it?
So
now?
I came back from the trade show and I wrote a big, you know, long report for my division. When I worked in aerospace, and I said, hey, we've got to upgrade all of our PCXTs to 286s because OS2 is going to come along. It's multitasking. It's solid. It's going to take over the world. And so we got to all get upgraded. And we bought a ton of these Mach 20 cards. Right. And of course, then OS2 died the death of a rag doll. But we had a bunch of fast PCXTs. So, you know, no worries there. I lived that one down. And the guy's right here. To find one in new old stock condition is amazingly rare. The price tag is, I don't know, you'd have to be a committed PC hobbyist to want to pay the $289 that he's asking for this. But
especially nowadays, because you can pick up an actual 286 so cheap. So you got to be really wanting this.
Right. Just find yourself an old clone 286 or a Packard Bell or, you know, something like that. I think I have an old Hulk of one of those sitting in the garage right now. So, yeah, you would have to be purist, you know, like I want to upgrade my PC like I did back in the old days. And actually, the super cool upgrade for the PCXT was when Intel came out with their 386 upgrade card. That thing was amazing. I don't remember what they called that. Did they call it the inboard 386 or the?
That sounds familiar.
Yeah, that was an awesome upgrade.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so yep, this Mach 20, you got 286 power. It's even got a 287 coprocessor.
But yeah, so the Intel inboard 386. I just did a search on Wikipedia real quick. Yeah, what was the disadvantage of upgrading with that though? I guess the bus, right? The 286 had an improved bus speed or something, didn't it?
What was the disadvantage of going to the 286 or the 386?
No, I'm sorry, with the Mach 20, with your item on eBay, what downsides were there?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the machine was faster and it could do more with the 286.
But it wasn't as fast as like a real AT, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
But it was cheaper. Like the reason I upgraded mine was I didn't want to invest a bunch of stuff, and that was way cheaper than trying to sell my computer and buy a new one.
Well, I mean, they didn't give those PCXTs away back in the days, and we had, I don't know, probably a couple hundred in my division, and there was no way we were going to turn over all those to buy IBM ATs, but we could afford to retrofit a significant portion of them with these boards.
So when OS2 does finally take off, you're going to be ready.
Those machines will be completely
Now, what's the... Because you guys are joking, man.
But OS 2 was pretty cool,
and it did have huge buzz. I had a couple of friends who were major OS 2 guys, and wow, they were zealous about their OS 2. OS 2 guys loved their OS 2.
Little known fact: up until not that terribly long ago, OS 2s ran a significant portion of the ATM machines that you use.
Yep. I didn't know that.
The thing was so solid that, you know, it lasted. It was like a legacy component in that market, like a vertical market. So,
cool. So last question, though. So you both had XTs, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Not the original PC, but the XT, which they had 8086s in them. Is that right?
8088s.
They had 8088s, too?
Mm-hmm.
So was that the significant difference between an XT and an AT? Wasn't the PC and XT a 16-bit processor on an 8-bit bus? And the AT was fully 16-bit?
Well, AT wasn't even quite fully 16-bit. I mean, I don't remember if it was Bill Gates, somebody prominent in the industry, called the 286 kind of a half-brain-dead processor. Because it was kind of, you know, the middle ground in between the 8088 and the 386. The 386, when things really started to take off.
Totally. Yeah, obviously. That's when it really, really gelled, was with 386 is when it went all full.
Until they made it brain-dead with the SX.
Yeah, but then I had my 486DX, which rocked. I liked my 486DX. Right. That was a good one.
Because really, the 386SX, basically all they did was they made it where it had a 16-bit bus, so you essentially manufacturers could stick it on 286 motherboards.
Yep.
And save money.
So, yeah, I wasn't a fan.
Well, it was a lot cheaper sometimes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the reason you had an 8088 in the XT.
Right. So. Oh, okay. So all right, moving along. So last thing is my item. And the reason I picked this is, so this is the Compact Portable 3, in this case the model 2660 vintage collectible. I'm not sure, well, there's the Compact Portable 3, and I'm not sure if there's like a 4 or 5, but the interesting thing about it is, is it has a gas plasma display.
Those red plasma screens were so cool.
And this one, the person says, they're not sure if it works or not, which, you know, can you plug it in maybe? then you can see if it works or not. What's the problem?
There was a discussion on that on the vintage computer forums recently. Like somebody was on the rant section saying, "Hey, you know, these silly eBay auctions. Not sure if works.
Yeah.
Find power cord and insert into wall socket.
Yeah, maybe you can't use it, but you can know whether it powers up and shows anything on the screen. So I always take, you know, not sure if it turns on for code 4. It doesn't turn on.
But I've always been fascinated with these. It's ironically a type of computer I've always wanted to acquire, and I never have. This particular one. So, you know, if this intrigues you, if you're interested, you could certainly. It's $185 on eBay. They do have a make offer. I would certainly not pay $185 for it, especially if they're not going to test it, at least to see if it powers on. But, you know, I would definitely email them. Could you find a standard power cord, plug it in, see if it just powers on? But it also shows, like, it's fraying at the keyboard a little bit, the cable, but it looks intact. But I just think that's pretty interesting. Do either of you guys have experience with a gas plasma display?
No.
Is it likely it would still work, you think? Or?
Oh, that I don't know. I used one of these computers back in the day. We had one as a portable network sniffer.
And it was awesome, wasn't it?
Yeah, because, you know, it's lunchbox design, right? We called them the compact lunchboxes. And so you could carry it around and open it up, had, you know, the slots in there so we could get the specialized network card into the machine, and the display was so amazing.
Wouldn't you just want to go to a Starbucks nowadays with that? Like, just talk about total hipster.
That would be
sit down, clacking away.
Find a plug.
I have a category, a classification for this, and I think, so these, which you could also call luggables, but I think, Earl, you're right, and this particular style I think was more called a lunchbox. So I think this was a very practical design, and these are some of the first examples of desktop replacement portables. You know, so this was like essentially a very portable, you know, could pretty much have the power and do the things of a real desktop computer.
I think that's how they were promoted
in the ads.
Versus
a laptop. Laptops were always very limited for a long time. Am I right?
You're right. Yeah, that's how they were promoted at the time. I saw lots of ads that would promote it exactly as that, like the luggable take your desktop with you sort of computer.
Yeah.
I mean, because, you know, you could argue that the original compact portable sort of started that trend, but it really wasn't portable. I mean, it was, but
It was movable.
It was, you wouldn't need to go to the gym if you were carrying that thing around very much. Right. Because that was its own exercise plan. So,
The luggables were, yes, you could, if you needed to, you could fly with them and take them somewhere and relocate to and be able to use it. But as a truly portable, I'm constantly on the go with it sort of a
thing.
Trying
to set that up working in a modern airplane. You pull down your tray, say, do you have a place I can plug this in? It'd be awesome.
Yeah, you know, Compaq, and they were a pretty innovative company there. I guess they had to really try harder, you know, back then. Because I don't know of any other companies that were sort of innovated that. And, you know, obviously the original portable, I guess you'd call it an innovation. They made the first IBM, you know, real 100% compatible. And they were the one of the first ones to have a 386, I think, on the market.
That was a big deal, actually, when the Compaq 386 came out prior to IBM introducing a 386 machine. Mm-hmm. That actually, you know, that was a foot in the door.
Yeah.
Compaq. That's actually the machine I think of. Yeah, when I think of Compaq, the one that comes to mind first is the Compaq 386. Like, to me, that's always been the one, yeah.
That hurt IBM in a lot of ways, the Despro 386.
Yeah, that's it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I had a Despro, the original Despro model, which was an 8086, not an 8088. It ran at 8 megahertz, and it was a screamer by comparison. I got that in 85, I think. It was a very nice machine, very well constructed. One of the problems that I always had with Compaq was their proprietary screws and proprietary parts. I mean, you know, I had a power supply go out on me, and I took it to the local Compaq authorized repair center. And I said, how much for replacing this power supply? They said, oh, you know, a mere $400. Wow. I thought, oh my gosh, I could get a clone power supply for $100, but it just doesn't fit. It's got the wrong stuff. It drove me crazy. So that part did kind of irritate me. But, you know, Saida, you're right, David. Compaq was very innovative in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And these lunchbox computers filled a niche that not many other things could tackle.
Right. Well, I know we've gotten a little long, so we're going to start wrapping it up. And, so really, in closing here, so Carrington, I'm going to hand it to you. We need to speak to about changing our feed and about our site finally going live.
Well, sure. By the time people hear this, they should be able to head over to rcrpodcast.com, which is the new site. If you are hearing this and having subscribed, then everything has worked well and you don't have to do anything. You've already moved over to the new feed. If you're not hearing this, I can't give you advice.
I'm gonna make a quick little announcement and it'll be posted just like a podcast.
Yeah, you know, just to let everybody know is because we're moving over to our own domain name, rcrpodcast.com, he said promoting it again. But we never used to be at the own domain name. And so that's the downside to transferring, and we're transferring from a site where it's impossible for us to do a 301 or a 302 redirect. So we're just going to have to cut the cord, drop the old feed, and submit a new one to iTunes. And but then going forward, since it'll be on rcrpodcast.com, he said promoting it again, that should stick with us even if we move providers, even no matter what happens in the future. Once you've got your own domain name, then all should be golden. So that's the joy. So our new site, which is hosted over at Squarespace, should be live. So anybody who's listening to this, maybe head over there and you can check out the new design.
And Earl, you got anything to add?
We got to thank the nice fellow who's providing us file hosting. The site may be on Squarespace.
Oh, yes, thank you.
But, Cyber Ears has really stepped up and is doing us a massive solid by supporting by hosting the actual MP3 files. So that's, like, totally amazing.
Cyber Ears is a powerful way to get sound to people using the Internet. By taking advantage of the latest in technologies, Cyber Ears offers a simple way to get your audio heard. Your message might be a regular audio talk show you want to release to people, or it might be your music, or it might be the audio recording of a meeting or service, or it might be a way to get important updates to your employees. Whatever your message is, if it can be recorded in sound, CyberEars.com is the mechanism you use to distribute it. We provide you the hosting and marketing tools needed to ensure you get heard. By using the latest technologies such as podcasts, we can provide you a place you can store your sound files easily and distribute them to the world without any technical headaches. You put your energies into recording great audio. We take care of the rest. We look forward to being your distribution partner for your audio recordings. With Cyber Ears, it's your audio on your terms.
Can't express how much we appreciate that, because it's a big deal, and it's really nice of him to do it. So thank you to Cyber Ears.
Yeah, that's right, Karen. So thanks a lot, Miles, for being a fan of the show and for helping us out with that.
Yeah, really fantastic.
So, okay, that's going to be it for this show. And as always, I want to thank everyone for listening and for supporting us. And I want to ask another special favor. We have some good reviews on iTunes, but I think we need more. We need more promotion, more reviews. Just help us get the word out, if you would. But so especially, would you please go to iTunes, just quickly do a quick review. I don't know how any of that works. It's all magic or whatever. But I think supposedly the more reviews you have, the more you can get noticed. And then we can get more listenership for the show. So I'm asking you, please pause a moment, go to iTunes, write us a nice review. We'd appreciate it. All our show notes will be, all the links and stuff will be in the show notes as usual. Don't forget our site, rcrpodcast.com. This is where you'll find the show notes and the podcast and so on from now on. And the email, we always read them, even though we don't always reply, so keep them coming. And we also invite audio feedback. Oh, and follow us on Twitter at rcrpodcast, at rcrpodcast. And so until next time, retrocompute.
Retrocompute!
Well done.